a baseball game, a day in a park with friends and family, fishing in a remote stream, work, travels, providing for loved ones, or heading out for adventures. Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. The original Guide to Men's Health is presented by the Washington State Urology Society to help take you through the steps necessary to get the most out of life. If you have invested in a retirement plan for your future, why not invest in your body? After all, it makes better sense to retire healthy and enjoy your future. These podcasts are a guide for how to take care of yourself. If you take care of your car and maintain it, why not do the same for your personal machine, your body? If you know you should but haven't yet, the information in these podcasts contains some easy recommendations for where, when, and how to get started. Follow the podcast as we explore men's health with renowned experts and embark on a journey towards better health. The old saying, you are what you eat, well, as cliche as it sounds, it continues to be true. Good health begins with a good diet. Today we speak with Marianne Neuhauser, RD, PhD, registered dietitian, from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Facility. Today's episode of the original Guide to Men's Health will be about nutrition. We're going to talk to a leading dietitian, Dr. Marian L. Neuhauser, PhD, RD. Marian is the program head, Cancer Prevention, Division of Public Health Science at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and affiliate professor, epidemiology, and core faculty, nutritional sciences at the University of Washington. Dr. Neuhauser, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So as we look at nutrition for a broad spectrum of population, and this is men's health, if I could make you the nutrition czar of the United States, what would you tell people who are listening?
Thank you. I'll base most of my comments and thoughts on the 2015 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. That is a policy document that was issued by both the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services after a very rigorous review of the literature on nutrition and health. And I was part of the scientific committee that produced the 2015 report that was turned into the policy document. What I think listeners would be most interested in hearing, and this applies to males and females across the age spectrum, is that what we recommended in the report is that people should be thinking about dietary patterns. In other words, you don't need to focus so much on minute amounts of nutrients. Did I get enough of this? Did I get too much of that? But focus on the overall diet, day in and day out, week to week, month to month, year to year. The scientific evidence base tells us that's the overall pattern of the diet that influences someone's weight and the risk for chronic disease rather than what you eat on any one day, such as Super Bowl Sunday or holidays. And that's really the most important thing to think about. The other thing that I think is helpful is that the science tells us that there's not one size that fits all. In other words, there are a number of healthy dietary patterns, and we presented this in our scientific report. We gave some examples for what we call a healthy U.S. diet, a healthy Mediterranean-style diet, which many listeners may have heard about the Mediterranean diet before, and also a healthy vegetarian dietary pattern. What these dietary patterns have in common is that most of them rely on having mostly a plant-based diet. And a plant-based diet doesn't necessarily mean that you can only eat salad or just eat vegetables. But think about plants first. So generous servings of fruits and vegetables throughout the day. Doesn't necessarily have to all be fresh, but often fresh tastes better and is more eye appealing. Lean protein, as opposed to processed meats and fried meats, whole grain. So really the majority of grains should be whole grain. We recommend that people have minimal amounts of what we call processed grains. So that would be white bread, white rice, white pasta, but instead opt for whole grains. They provide a lot of fiber, satiety, they help keep cholesterol levels low, and so forth. We also recommend low-fat dairy, and even in the vegetarian dietary pattern, it's important to remember that the plant milk substitutes that are dairy-like or milk-like that are very popular these days, such as almond milk, other plant milks, they don't have the same nutrient profile as dairy milk. So people who were choosing to have, say, almond milk, soy milk, coconut milk, any number of other options that are available from plant milks, that if they're using those types of plant milks for a protein or a calcium or a vitamin D source, they should check the label to see if those plant milks have been enriched or fortified with those ingredients, because it's not a one-for-one swap, a dairy milk with a plant milk. The healthy dietary patterns also have a minimal amount of added sugars, minimal amount of saturated fat, which primarily comes from animal foods, but can also come from some plant fats, and decreased amounts of sodium. Sodium primarily comes from cooking, adding foods, adding salt at the table, and also from highly processed foods. So people wonder, what are highly processed foods? Processed foods is really a loaded term. People often wonder about processed foods. There's a lot of popular literature that demonizes anything that's processed. But a can of tomatoes is technically a processed food because it's been cooked, they're in a can, they may have slight amounts of other things added to them. That's not necessarily an evil food. What we call highly processed is something that has gone through many levels of processing and has a lot of added ingredients. So many of the sugar-sweetened breakfast cereals, potato chips, which don't resemble a potato at all, it's mostly a vehicle for oil and fat, and some foods like that. But I don't want listeners to be afraid of having anything processed. You don't have to have only fresh foods in your diet. After all, yogurt is a processed food. It's processed milk, and that's a very healthy option to include in the diet.
So if we look at the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, it is a wonderful document. It is a large document, and it's free. There are diet books. There are recommendations from diet gurus. You can find them by searching the web. You can go into a bookstore and find a gazillion different aspects of what to eat and how to eat, how to stay healthy, how to live longer. But this document, which is free and can be downloaded, I think contains the essence of what we need. And I wish more people knew about it. So it can be found just by a web search under the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. And it has to be put out every 5 years or so.
That's correct. It's congressionally mandated to be issued every 5 years.
And it's truly an expert panel, and you served
yes,
on the
last. Yes, it is an expert panel. There's a very rigorous process for selecting who will serve on the panel. And in addition to the rigorous process whereby people have to have scientific expertise in nutrition and chronic disease, you know, and diseases across the lifespan, they also have to be free of conflicts of interest, meaning that they do not receive funding from food companies, pharmaceutical companies. They don't have published books promoting a particular type of diet. So that's a very rigorous part of the vetting process as well.
So it really is the science.
Yes, it is the science.
What I like about the document when I read through it is not only is the information here as to what is best as far as diet and how to approach diet, but also the way to change your eating habits is included. So it's worth having a population have this in hand and be able to refer to it. What were some of the tricks that you used to take a population who may be listening saying, well, I know I don't eat that well, and I want to be eating in a more healthy fashion. How do you get people to change?
That's a great question. Changing one's diet, or in fact any behaviors, even physical activity, is hard. it's not that easy, because anything that we are used to, that's easier to do than doing something that's harder. The Dietary Guidelines for Americans policy document does provide some very helpful tips for ways that people can change their eating behaviors. One of the things that I think is the most useful for people is to start cooking, because when you cook your own meals, you can control the ingredients, you can control the amount of added fat, added sugar, salt, all those things you can control. And you can also control your portion sizes that you put onto your plate. Our culture is changing in terms of eating out. You know, 30, 40 years ago, it was a treat to eat out in a restaurant. People might have done it a couple of times a month. You know, wealthier families may have done it once a week. And today, about half of all meals are eaten away from home. That's what population data tells us, half. So when people eat more, not necessarily at home, but prepare their own food, say, prepare your lunch at home rather than going to the local fast food place or the cafeteria at work that may not have healthy options. Prepare your own food at home, take it to work or school or whatever your day is like. I'm not saying don't eat out in restaurants, you know, because that's an enjoyable part of eating. We want to be able to enjoy our food, enjoy the company of other people, but really make it a treat, not an everyday occurrence. So cooking one's own food, learning how to cook, can really help people to improve their dietary habits.
And for those that just by necessity do go for fast food, there are now some choices in most of the fast food establishments. You would steer people towards more fruit, vegetables?
Yes, and especially whole grains and less fried options in those particular establishments.
Now, going back to appropriate diets and disease, we have a healthy population of young people. We'd like to steer them into eating habits that we just discussed. But say we have someone who discovers that they have a propensity for elevated cholesterol, cardiac disease in their family. How would you design eating for that person?
Again, it's not a one-size-fits-all, but trying to find out where that individual patient may be. What are their current eating habits? What are their current exercise habits? For someone with elevated LDL, it's usually a good idea to keep the saturated fat at 5% or less of the whole diet, and there's ways to do that. It typically requires eating fewer animal products because most of the saturated fat in the diet comes from animal products, and that induces LDL cholesterol. So instead of butter on bread, find some other spread, honey, even, you know, a little bit of jam or just plain bread. Use low or non-fat dairy products. Trim the meat, trim the fat off of meat, use lean cuts, and again, try sources of vegetable protein, beans, lentils, and so forth.
And cooking with oil, one of the staples of preparing food, there are better oils, the saturated versus unsaturated, vegetable oil versus, what is your recommendation?
Well, what the scientific evidence base tells us is that oils that are high in polyunsaturated fatty acid, so this would be most of the vegetable oils, are probably better than, say, cooking with coconut oil, or I've even seen avocado oil on the store shelves recently. We thought for a long time that the use of olive oil was going to be better than the polyunsaturated fatty acid oils. It's not necessarily the case. I think we still need to do some investigating on those oils and on the long-term use of, say, olive oil that's higher in monounsaturated fatty acids versus polys. So the jury's still out a little bit on that one, if they're equivalent or one is better than the other. The evidence is slightly tilted towards the PUFAs rather than the monounsaturated fatty acids, but we'll see how that evidence plays out.
And then going back to at-risk populations, where we're talking about cardiac risk or diabetics, there are usually programs, and if not, at least the availability
of meeting with a registered dietitian for dietary counseling. This isn't something that somebody has to take on by themselves.
That's right. Registered dietitians are wonderful sources of providing correct and accurate nutrition information and providing helpful tips for how to follow a healthy diet.
So for populations at risk and specific subpopulations, they can seek dietary counseling. Sometimes it will be integrated into the care they're receiving. Sometimes they may need to go find it on their own. Where would they go on their own to receive dietary counseling?
If they're not able to receive dietary counseling through their healthcare provider, they can go to the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics website, and there should be a link for finding an RD in your area.
Excellent. If we then, of course, want to explore diet, which everyone always wants to do, is I need to diet. How do we diet and what is the preferred diet? And is there a better diet as far as dieting?
So when you refer to dieting, I think you're referring to a weight loss diet.
Yes.
So as your listeners may be aware, 2/3 of our population are overweight or obese. So that means having a body mass index of 25 or over for overweight, a body mass index of 30 or more to be obese. It really is an epidemic in this country that is not abating at all. Being overweight or obese is associated with a plethora of chronic diseases, type 2 diabetes in particular, but also cardiovascular disease, colorectal cancer, and a number of other disorders. Achieving and maintaining a healthy weight is possible, but I really want listeners to hear is that if you see a diet book or hear something from a diet guru that sounds too good to be true, it probably is. There's a lot of money to be made in selling weight loss books, weight loss schemes, paying a lot of money to join a weight loss program with special foods or special pills. And I would urge people not to do those, not to get swayed into the get rich quick schemes or the lose weight quick schemes, because often they do not work in the long term. Weight loss is achievable with improved diet. It always takes reducing calories, and it helps to increase physical activity, but there's no special foods that will make you lose weight without other changes such as reducing calories. There's no special pills. There's no one food that causes weight loss or weight gain, with the possible exception of sugar-sweetened beverages, because they really are just nothing but drinking sugar.
So in a quote, effort to lose weight through, quote, dieting, a choice of more healthy foods would certainly be appropriate.
That's correct.
Portion control?
Correct.
Looking towards addition of exercise, small steps, but we need calories going out if we're going and reducing calories mm-hmm. going in. But it has to be sustainable. So then we want to find a diet that, okay, I like these foods, I may be preparing these foods, I'm going to be consuming these over time because I want to continue to maintain the effects of the weight loss that I just achieved. What diet do you find in your research, in your clinical experience, seems to be sustainable for people?
The best diet is one that someone will stay on. And what we found through our evidence review in the 2015 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee is that many of these healthy dietary patterns are also not only associated with reducing the risk of diet-related chronic diseases, but they can be related to weight loss and maintaining weight. In fact, one study that I was part of here where we used data from the Women's Health Initiative, which is the largest study on postmenopausal women's health that this country has ever done. And here at the Fred Hutch, we are the clinical coordinating center for the WHI. We had some DEXA measures of body composition on a subset of women, and we could track those over time. And so we did a data analysis a few years ago where we examined several of these healthy dietary patterns, including the Mediterranean diet pattern, something called the Healthy Eating Index that assesses someone's adherence to the dietary guidelines. And what the data showed was that when people adhere to those healthful dietary patterns, they tend to have less body fat on those DEXA measures. So it wasn't self-reported fat, it really was measures, you know, on an objective scale.
So one of the ways to diet that I heard that lose easy calories is to avoid alcohol. I've had patients tell me that when they avoided alcohol, they dropped a number of pounds very quickly and found it very sustainable and felt better. So in the guidelines, they address alcohol use?
We did address alcohol use, but we did not come to any firm conclusions about alcohol because there are some chronic diseases and weight for which alcohol consumption increases the risk. Weight gain is one, breast cancer, a few others, and then some for which alcohol is associated with a lower risk, namely cardiovascular disease. So we don't really have a one-size-fits-all for alcohol, but you are correct in that alcohol does add calories. It, in fact, has almost as many calories per gram as fat. Alcohol has 7 calories per gram, fat has 9 calories per gram, carbohydrate and protein have 4 calories per gram. So if someone wants to lose weight and is willing to cut down their alcohol, it's really a very easy way to cut out calories.
And then moderate to maintain the calorie loss.
Yes.
And if we were to look towards available guides, you know, what can somebody access easily that would give them some idea on how to construct a week's worth of meals? I mean, just something you could go to on the web or that you could recommend. Do you have or is it in the guide here?
It's in the dietary guidelines. We have a number of menu suggestions, recipe options. It's all on the Dietary Guidelines for Americans.
So, wonderful document. You don't have to go out and buy a diet book. It's downloadable. It's free.
And it's based on science.
And it's all there.
And no one's trying to make any money off of it.
Which is amazing. You know, we're a culture here that wants medication for my reflux, wants medication for my high blood pressure, wants medication to reduce my blood sugar, wants medication to help me sleep better, wants medication if there's something to help me lose weight. And yet, so many studies have demonstrated that weight loss and exercise solve so many of those conditions that you don't need medication for. Simple. Weight loss, exercise. But I think you're emphasizing that you want to find something that works for each individual. It isn't one size fits all. Find something that a person likes, that they find sustainable, that they'll stay with. But the cornerstone is really the choice of what they're going to be taking in.
That's right. And what I might add to your comments as well is that following a healthy diet, engaging in physical activity, maintaining a healthy weight, those all reduce healthcare costs as well. So we hear a lot about healthcare expenditures these days, the high cost of medications, especially for patients who may be on Medicare or other managed plans where they may or may not have to pay a high copay for their medications. There are a number of seniors that might be on 2, 3, 4 of some of those medications that you mentioned. So the more that we can do to prevent those diet-related physical activity, obesity-related chronic diseases, the fewer of those medications they will have to take and spend copay money out of their pocket, and our whole healthcare expenditures hopefully can come down. Now, there still will be some people who will need medications because they may have a family history of hypertension, you know, or family history of hyperlipidemia that really does need to be controlled by medication. So if their healthcare provider recommends that they take something, they should do that. I don't want anyone to avoid their medication, but they still should follow a healthy dietary pattern, such as many of the options that we presented in the dietary guidelines, engage in physical activity, and maintain a healthy weight.
So you bring up a very interesting question that there are many people who have said, well, I try to eat healthy, but it costs me more money. It's more expensive to eat a healthy diet. Their fast food is cheaper. But the payback is if you can reduce your medication costs, you can make up for what you need to spend for healthier food.
That's correct. And I think that there are some misconceptions about food costs and healthy food costs. If someone is going to eat fast food versus a more expensive healthy meal, then yes, the fast food drive-through may be cheaper. It's almost always true that if you cook at home, you're going to spend less money than if you eat out at a restaurant.
Well, let's just explore a little bit about vitamins and supplements. We're a culture that likes to find, again, results in a pill. And supplements are a huge industry with no science necessarily backing many of the supplements. I've been told that our cereals are so fortified with vitamins that the old multivitamin that had a high dose is giving you too much extra vitamin now, because you're getting vitamin in your milk, you're getting vitamins in your cereal, vitamins in other food substances. So what's your advice on supplements? And let's start with just vitamins.
That's an excellent question. I've actually done quite a bit of research on dietary supplements, both in the general population as well as in various high-risk groups. Foods began to be fortified in this country in the 1940s, when we still had a lot of deficiency diseases in this country as well as around the world. We very rarely see deficiency diseases anymore, but we haven't changed our food fortification practices. The one exception may be the fortification of enriched cereal grains with folic acid to help prevent neural tube defect affected pregnancy. That one, I think, is a very helpful fortification program, because most women do not realize that they are pregnant until after the neural tube has closed. And they may not be taking enough folic acid either in the diet or through dietary supplements. So fortification of the food supply does help prevent those devastating birth defects. And after that program was instituted in 1998, we did see a drop in the number of cases of spina bifida and anencephaly. They're devastating. Doesn't mean that they don't happen anymore. They still do happen, but the incidence is lower. But other ways that we fortify food, for instance, iodine and salt, we very rarely see goiters anymore. It's hard to tell whether that fortification has helped prevent them or whether we have such a varied food supply now that people can naturally get iodine other places. We don't know the answer to that question. Most of the research shows us that people who take multivitamins or other single supplements already have a healthy diet. So it's sort of the worried well who take supplements and they don't really need them. And many of the higher dose supplements actually cause more harm than good.
So it doesn't mean more is better.
That's correct. More is not better. Most of the nutrients that are in multivitamins are micronutrients, and they're called micronutrients for a reason. Your body needs all of them, but only in very, very small amounts. They are components of enzymes. They are building blocks for bone and muscle, such as calcium and vitamin D, which has a number of uses in the body, but you don't need large amounts of them. It's almost always been shown that when we do these trials where we give study participants these high doses, it almost always causes more harm than good, or it's a null finding.
So there are side effects to certain vitamins that can lead to dire consequences and
That's
problems.
Correct.
I know that when we do surgery, we tell patients to stop all supplements at least a couple of weeks before, mm-hmm. because unknown to the patient, certain supplements can increase bleeding disorders.
Yes.
So when you look at supplements, if somebody comes in with a laundry list of things that they take, how do you know what is good and what isn't good? I mean, is there any guide to supplements?
We do have an Office of Dietary Supplements at the National Institutes of Health. And that office was created in the mid-1990s when a new law was passed called the Dietary Supplement and Health Education Act. That act was passed and it basically deregulated the supplement industry. It was after 1995 that we saw this explosion of supplement availability in this country. Most grocery stores and pharmacies have supplement aisles instead of a supplement shelf now. That only happened after 1995. That legislation mandated that the Office of Dietary Supplements be created not only to monitor the use of supplements in this country, but also to provide consumer education. And they are located on the web at ods.gov. They have a number of very useful pieces of information on all kinds of dietary supplements, ranging from multivitamins to single supplements to botanical supplements. They also have a small research funding program where they give out small grants to investigators around the country who are doing research on dietary supplements.
The problem with supplements is there doesn't have to be documentation of the outcome, meaning a supplement maker can make a claim and they don't have to prove it.
That's correct. Dietary supplements do not fall under the same level of rigor for showing safety and efficacy, meaning does the product work, as say cold medicine or pain relievers, any over-the-counter medication that someone wants to buy. They have to have consistent formulations, they have to show that it works, they have the insert that shows all the testing and so forth. Dietary supplements, even though they look like medication on the shelf to a consumer, they do not fall under that same level of rigor. In fact, the burden is not on the regulatory agencies to monitor that. So dietary supplements are basically an unregulated industry.
Did the committee who put together the Dietary Guidelines for Americans have any recommendations for supplements that they would say you should take?
We did not delve into supplements very much because it's mostly a food-based recommendation. There were a couple of places when we were examining the scientific literature where it came up, but we mostly recommended that if people have a varied diet, they can obtain all the needed micronutrients that they need.
In our goals to promote healthy eating, weight loss, try to curb the obesity epidemic, I looked towards our neighbors to the north for guidance. When I was doing some research, I found that the Canadian Obesity Foundation was just a wonderful resource in helping people lose weight. Canadian Men's Health Foundation has small changes, and part of that is don't make a big goal. Don't try to do something rapidly. Do something like we've been talking about that's sustainable, that you can make constant changes over time. So when the committee looked at changing eating habits and tried to incorporate appropriate healthy diet, if I wanted some additional resources that I could find quickly, what would I do to help guide me through that? Are there some tricks? Are there devices now with things that can monitor? Or, you know, how would you help keep people on the right path?
That's an excellent question. I wish that we had a Fitbit for food. So if someone wears a Fitbit or other device where they can track their steps or their exercise, that can provide really helpful feedback to people. It's even on most smartphones now. If you keep your smartphone in your pocket, it will tell you automatically how many steps you had that. There are a number of apps and other ways to obtain nutrient information out there. They're not all what I would call research grade, so I don't quite trust them because I don't know where they're getting their nutrient data from. Food is really complex. You know, consumers have access to about 60,000 different food items, and then when you think about those in various combinations, we have a complex food supply. We don't eat the same thing every day. So to think that one could just have an app that told them all the different combinations of foods, and that was how many calories that they were getting, it's a little bit more, food's more complex than that.
We can, though, have people calculate their BMI.
Yes.
They can go online and do that. And if your BMI is over 25, then you ought to start thinking about increasing exercise and start thinking about the way that you eat.
Correct.
And there are ways of looking at your calorie intake. I know that there's calorie calculators online that you can look at your weight, your height, find what calories you should be at to sustain a normal BMI, and then, quote, dietary restrictions, BMIs, reduction calculators, and food groups that give you calories. Those things useful?
I think they're useful. And one thing that has started over the last several years is many restaurants who post the calorie information of the menu items. And I would urge people to take a look at those. And if they are out for a restaurant meal, that can help them make selections. If they see that something is, say, 1,000 calories, is that really the choice they want versus something that may be 500 or 600 calories? It adds up quick.
So if somebody finds something that works, that's sustainable, stick with it. One size doesn't fit all, but it is all based in appropriate food choice, quantity, and increasing exercise.
That's right. And I think I might add as well that one of the things that we did on the 2015 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee was use a framework called the Social Ecological Model. And what that model is used throughout behavioral sciences. And what it says is that there are multiple influences on someone's life. And it can be applied to nutrition, physical activity, any number of other things. So it's not just individual choice. So the social ecological model says that there's the individual, the family, the community, society, policy, all of these things influence someone's health and well-being. So people can make individual food choices that can help them along the way. But we also need to educate employers to make sure that, say, there's a refrigerator on site. So if someone wants to bring their lunch and have a healthier lunch, they have a place to put it. Maybe there's walking path at places of work. We talk a lot about bad traffic here in Seattle. Maybe there's ways that we can walk to work instead of always relying on either public transportation or a single automobile, so people can get their exercise when they're going to and from work. Are there policies that can make it easier for people to follow a healthy diet? And I'm talking about, you know, government policies that just make it easier rather than just relying only on the individual. It's a multi-tiered system. It's not just individual choice, although that's a big part of it.
And again, they can find the Dietary Guidelines for Americans online, and this document will come up.
That's correct. Dietaryguidelines.gov.
Wonderful. Well, anything else that you'd like people to know? Any last comments?
I think my last comments would be, while we have a growing scientific evidence base suggesting that a healthy diet will help reduce the risk of many chronic diseases and help keep people at a healthy weight, we also want people to enjoy their food, both with their families, friends, social gatherings. We want people to enjoy themselves. So people should not feel guilty for having a once in a while meal or gathering that might have foods that would be less healthy. So really enjoy yourself with your food and your family, friends, and loved ones.
And last question, if you were to choose one culture in the entire world that had the best diet, who's been studied to be that culture?
There's quite a bit of evidence that shows that a Mediterranean-style diet is associated with lower risk of many chronic diseases. In fact, there was a very famous clinical trial that was published a few years ago, the PREDIMED trial. That was a study that was done in the Mediterranean regions of Europe. And in that trial, they asked people to consume extra virgin olive oil, nuts every day, typically walnuts, and follow a Mediterranean-style diet that had generous servings of vegetables, fruit, fish, plant proteins, modest amounts of dairy. And it showed lower risk of cardiovascular disease and many cancers. So I would say that Mediterranean-style diet is a very healthy one.
And it tastes good.
Yes, it does.
Well, Dr. Neuhauser, thank you so much for spending time with us. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
This completes another podcast chapter of the Washington State Urology Society's original Guide to Men's Health. This is Dr. Richard Pellman reminding you to take care of yourself. The Washington State Urology Society wishes to thank all contributors who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The Society also wishes to thank Sean Fox for his invaluable technical assistance. Music theme, San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. Dave Weidig. The podcasts are the property of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the express consent of the Society is strictly prohibited. For more information about men's health, visit wsus.org or visit your physician or care provider.